He didn't. Marcy couldn't process it. It couldn't be true, could it? Jason's always so upset when he talks about his father's death, the loss, how he had to build himself back up and get everyone's respect again. Jackie shook her head. Jason was the only child, the golden child. Michael blamed himself for spoiling him, for the whole country day lifestyle that can be great for those kids with drive, but for the few like Jason, who are mainly arrogance and no substance, it can make them greedy. Jason was greedy, but it wasn't Michael's fault. It was just his nature. So why? I mean, he killed himself. Surely he wouldn't have done that if he wasn't guilty. He took the blame for Jason. His wife moved back to Jacksonville and wanted nothing to do with him. She died in a car crash shortly after, drunk at the wheel. Her family said it was the shame of it all. Michael was alone, and I think he realized the enormity of what was going to happen to him. He couldn't face the jail time and wasn't sure he could maintain his story without buckling and telling the truth, or getting caught out in lies and accidentally revealing his innocence. I think he came to believe that suicide was the only way to really protect Jason. Oh, God, Marcy said. It gets worse, Jackie said. Jason knew he was going to do it. He told me his father was talking about it. The day he hanged himself, he rang Jason drunk to say he loved him and would always protect him. It was a goodbye phone call. I knew it. Jason knew it. I told him to go around right away to make sure his dad was okay, but he didn't. He finished his coffee, let another half an hour go by before he went. I think on some level he was happy his dad had taken his own life. He didn't have to worry anymore. The creaking rope, moments too late. And nobody suspected Jason at all? Could this still be part of some twisted plan of Jackie's? Marcy wanted to cling to that idea, but somewhere inside everything she said felt true. The dead look on Jason's face sometimes, the way he lied so smoothly. Sociopath sprang to mind. She felt a sudden, mildly hysterical urge to laugh. Eleanor, maybe. She'd known Michael since they were young, and she liked his gentleness. I don't think she ever trusted Jason after Michael's suicide. Eleanor was perceptive. Maybe Michael had even said something to her about it. They had been close. I think she saw Jason's relief when his father died. It stank of guilt. She looked up at Marcy, suddenly seeming a lot younger than her years. Vulnerable. I told you we were going to need something stronger. And you knew all this? And never told anyone? I thought I could get past it. I couldn't. Why do you think I was so bitter during the divorce? I'd carried this shit around with me for years, so much guilt. He didn't feel it at all. He sailed through life while I couldn't ever sleep, trying to run away from it all at night gyms. So yeah. When he decided to trade me in for you, I was angry. I wasn't jealous. I didn't love him anymore. But I hated that he thought he could end it so easily, as if what I knew didn't matter. And I guess it didn't, because I never told anyone. I was too scared of implicating myself. But now... She smiled, momentarily joyful. He was arrogant enough to do it again, and now he's going to get his comeuppance. He's finally going to pay in some way for what happened to Michael. So you had nothing to do with what happened to William? Marcy was still struggling to get her head around the wider picture. God, no, Jackie said. I mean, I didn't like William very much, and Eleanor deserved better. But then don't most women? I had already been planning to talk to the police, or at least William, about my suspicions that Jason might be stealing. But then when William was poisoned, I obviously suspected Jason of that too. That's why I went to the hospital, to fish for information. That's where I'd heard there'd been some tension, and then I knew I had to say something. Marcy had to admit that after hearing all this, she'd suspect him too if she hadn't spoken to him face to face. Sociopathic liar or not, she still thought he'd told her the truth. I don't think he poisoned William, Marcy said. I don't actually care, Jackie countered. I'd still be happy for him to go to jail for it. Karma and comeuppance and all that shit. But I'll settle for the embezzlement charges. Who knows, maybe they'll look back at what happened with Michael and reinvestigate. The ghosts will always come for you. Marcy was learning that. So you didn't send the yearbook to Jason? Your crazy past? No. Jackie smiled. I never liked you much, but you also didn't interest me enough to want to know about you. My hate was directed at Jason. Have you considered that maybe he sent that to himself, to keep you quiet, or to keep you as a backup plan? If the police started suspecting him, he could throw your past at them. They'd see the coincidences in the deaths, and then no death penalty for Jason. That would only work if he was guilty, Marcy said. And as I said, I don't think he is. And my jury is still out on that one. They finished their champagne in silence. Why did you come back? Marcy asked, as she finally led Jackie back to the front door. I was alone again, and I have good friends here, good people. Coming up when Eleanor was sick reminded me of that. I'd got so caught up in hating Jason, I'd forgotten that most people weren't like that. Most people in this town were more like Michael and Eleanor. Kind, sweet, caring. She stepped out into the humid gray afternoon. Overhead, the heavy blanket of cloud was turning black, but the air was oven roasting. And of course, I wanted to haunt Jason, to wait for him to slip up in some way, watch him, find some way to pass his guilt back to him, and maybe get a good night's sleep again. I guess that worked, Marcy said as Jackie headed back to her car. Hey, she called out after the woman she'd so long considered an enemy, and now didn't know quite how to feel about. One more thing. Jackie turned. What? Who do you know in Savannah who's into voodoo, maybe? Something like that? Jackie laughed. We're in the South, Marcy. Most people have some belief in it. Why'd you ask? It's probably nothing. She wasn't going to share all that stuff with Jackie. She still didn't like her. She raised a hand to wave her off. And thank you for telling me about Jason. Marcy felt hollow, turned inside out. She'd married a monster and not even noticed. Worse than that, there was still someone out there coming after her, who she figured wanted Marcy in as much trouble as Jason was. And it wasn't Jackie. So who? She had one more lead to follow. She threw the rest of her champagne away and made a strong coffee. Despite her fear, she wasn't done yet. 60. The doll was on the passenger seat beside her, now filled with ominous portent like a ventriloquist dummy in a horror film. Her thoughts kept coming back to church. That inner congregation she'd watched at William's service, that passion. Wars were fought over religion all over the world, so it wasn't such a leap that a congregation would follow a minister's wishes or act for fellow worshippers. Puppets having their strings pulled. Was the voodoo church any different? She thought about the strange open-air celebration she and Keisha had gone to. How they'd ended up there had been contrived, too. The way that girl had knocked into their drinks and started chatting. If they hadn't met those two girls, they'd never have gone, danced, made wishes, and gotten naked. She'd called Tiger Court at Savannah State University and asked to speak to Jade or Daria, but the woman at the other end was adamant that there were no students with those names staying there. Had the girls been tasked with getting Keisha and Marcy to the rave, and under the gaze of the old black woman with the orange hair? But why? To add to Keisha's belief she was cursed? Or to actually curse them. But if someone was after Jason and Marcy, what did Keisha have to do with it? Keisha believed. That much was true. It was in her blood. That's what she'd said. In her family. Marcy glanced across at the doll again. Well, it wasn't in Marcy's, and she refused to get freaked out about it. Outside, the sky rumbled, portentous, and Marcy placed her foot on the pedal harder. She knew where she had to go. You think just because I'm black, I secretly practice voodoo? Zelda burst into laughter, something Marcy, standing in the doorway getting wet, realized she'd never seen before.
I'm a Christian, a Baptist just like Mr. William.
Zelda looked down at the doll Marcy was still holding, which she'd thrust out at Zelda in a dramatic gesture, but Zelda had refused to take.
I don't know what that is or what it's for. I didn't make it.
But Keisha saw you, St. John's Eve. You were at the party we went to, down by the Truman Parkway, where the old black lady with the orange hair did some crazy song and dance. I need to know where to find her.
Danse, Kalinda. We call on them to dance with us, the spirits, the ghosts, les grands zombies.
Marcy could still feel the earth pounding under her. Zelda was still chuckling.
Oh my, I'm too old to go to parties. And that Keisha is crazy. She drinks too much to believe anything she says. Maybe she did see someone she knew, but it wasn't me. I don't like her much. She can be rude.
She paused, and her face grew flinty.
But I like her better than I like you, Mrs. Maddox. And if you don't mind, I want you to leave now. I have to go and open up the big house for Miss Iris shortly, and I have some chores to finish first.
Iris? Marcy asked. She didn't even know the police had finished with the house.
She's coming to go through Mrs. Radford's things. The first Mrs. Radford.
Lightning shattered the gloom of the afternoon, and for a moment Marcy got a glimpse into Zelda's apartment beyond the small woman. It was perfectly ordinary, no signs of anything remotely weird. But then what had she expected?
So who made this? Marcy asked, exasperated.
How the hell would I know?
Zelda's laugh was filled with disgust.
You should be ashamed of yourself. Maybe go ask some white ladies.
She slammed the door in Marcy's face, leaving her alone with the rain, her unanswered questions, and the creepy doll. The emptying clouds were so thick that although it was still afternoon, the sky was almost black, lit up with crackles and flashes of lightning. Zelda had only opened the side gate for her, and by the time Marcy ran back to her car, parked around the corner, she was soaked to the skin. Inside, she locked the doors, shivering against the seat and glancing around, paranoid that there were people watching her. The sidewalks under the heavy canopies of trees were silent. Somehow, that made her nervousness worse.
It's just bullshit, Savannah, she told herself, her old name clawing up from where she'd buried it. There are no such things as voodoo curses and magic. Whatever is being done to you, there's a flesh and blood person doing it, for flesh and blood reasons.
Still, she jumped when her cell phone rang. It was Detective Anderson.
So,
the officer started, in that laconic drawl that made Marcy want to carve her eyes out with a spoon.
Seems we've got some news on your mysterious yearbook. Guess who the email requesting it came from?
You're the detective, Marcy said, her jaw tight, in no mood for any more games. You tell me.
Well, here's the thing. It came from you.
What? Marcy sat up straighter. That couldn't be right. It didn't. I didn't email them.
The request came from a Gmail account in the name of Savannah Cassidy.
I don't care where it came from. I didn't send it.
I'm sure. But we'll soon know. We're checking the computers taken from your house and Jason's office to see if there's a history of any of them accessing that account. You know a funny thing, though?
Marcy was sure it was going to be hysterical.
What? The office secretary remembers a woman coming in to collect it a couple of months back. A blonde woman, not too tall. That's what she remembers.
Marcy thought of Jason's father, and as her own lungs constricted in fear, she figured she knew how he'd felt, dangling on the rope, his life being taken from him.
If it was me, then why would I have even told you about the email to the school, that a woman had asked for the yearbook? Why would I draw attention to myself that way? Why would I report it? With her free hand, she tugged at the roots of her hair, something she hadn't done in years. Her life was unraveling again. No, someone was unraveling it. For a long moment, all she could hear was the rain on the car roof and Anderson breathing in her ear.
"You tell me, Marcy,"
Anderson said eventually.
"You tell me."
And then she hung up.
Shit, shit, shit!
Marcy banged the phone hard against the steering wheel as she cursed loudly in the empty car as rain slashed against her windshield. The email would trace back to her somehow, she knew it. She beat the phone against the wheel again 3 times more, and as she did, lightning blew up the sky, and a tall figure appeared from nowhere in front of her car. It was her. Marcy shrieked, shocked. The old black woman with hair the color of autumn fire. In the flash of light, she beat her cane against the metal hood 3 times, and even though the storm was starting to rage outside and the woman's lips didn't move, Marcy was sure she heard her call, "Faith! Hope! Charity!" Marcy flinched, and when she looked up again, the street ahead was empty. Breathless, she spun around in her seat. Where was she? Where? More lightning cut the sky. And in the bright beam, the woman was standing behind the trunk, cane raised. She brought it down 3 times again.
"Danse, Kalinda!"
she shouted to the skies, her voice filled with joy. She beat the trunk again.
"You hear me in there? Make them dance, les grands zombies!"
"Hey!"
Marcy shouted, her frantic fingers struggling to lift the lock on her door. She was here. The woman was here, and now that Marcy's heart had stopped racing in panic, she just wanted some answers.
"Hey, wait!"
Finally, she got the door open and stumbled out into the storm. The old woman was walking away, immune to the elements as if out strolling on a summer's day.
"Hey!"
Marcy called out again. She picked up her pace, the fat woman ahead somehow moving fast, although she seemed to be only shuffling.
"Wait!"
Marcy repeated. In reply, the woman raised her cane to the sky and shook it, shouting words Marcy couldn't hear. And then lightning cracked like a gunshot into a tree behind Marcy, and she couldn't help but duck and spin around, huddling behind her car, as a splinter of trunk shot across the pavement. When she turned again, the rain suddenly easing as if even the storm was shocked by the lightning's attack, the old woman was gone. Marcy got to her feet and leaned against the car trunk, watching the smoke from the burned tree drifting into the rain. She was frustrated and angry, and more than a little afraid. Where had the old woman come from? How did she know where Marcy was going to be? Was someone following her? What did she mean with her sayings and her chants? Marcy looked down, the black gray of the clouds above letting cracks of calm blue in as the storm marched relentlessly onward. The old woman had been shouting at something in the trunk.
"You hear me in there, make them dance!"
Marcy's fingers trembled as she reached for the catch, and the sleek metal lifted silently. Flies, hundreds of them, buzzed loudly as they rushed past in a swarm, and she swatted around her head, disgusted, until the air was clear. She looked down, half expecting to see a rotting corpse tied up against the carpet, a gift to Anderson, and a final nail in Marcy's coffin. But there was no such body. And at first, the trunk seemed empty. It was only as she peered more closely to brush away a few lingering, sickly flies that she saw it, dark against dark. She picked it up. A ball, black and lumpy as if made of mud, dredged up from the bed of a stagnant river filled with rot. Not mud, she thought, rolling it around in her hands in horror. Earth and dirt, and something else. What was that? She got back in the car and flicked on the light before recoiling in horror. Was that fur? Black fur? She rubbed the surface harder and looked at her fingers, a deep, dark red. Blood and earth and fur bound together. There was something more, catching her eye. At first, she thought it was strands of cotton bound through the revolting sphere, but as she picked one free, she saw it was hair. Blonde hair. Her hair. Maybe Keisha was right. Maybe they were cursed.
61.
Tell us about the boy.
Keisha stared at the man across the table, her heart fluttering like a leaf caught in the storm outside.
Auntie Io said I was cursed. She said there was no boy. She said I was seeing a ghost, and I'd upset the spirits because I was a wicked little girl. She said I had to stop talking about him, otherwise the curse would never go. I had to forget about him.
You didn't forget about him, though, did you?
No, she said quietly. And look where I am now.
I don't think you're cursed, Keisha, he said.
And she wondered what someone like him could possibly know about it. He was a heavy-set man, old enough that the skin of his jaw hung in jowls, dragging him downward toward his grave. His aftershave was clean, not suffocating and floral like Billy's. His accent was gruff and London, the words clipped and hard next to the sweet Savannah drawl, but oh, how she'd missed it. He was steady and sturdy, and she doubted he dreamed. His name was Detective Sergeant Dexter.
Tell us when you first saw him, he said.
He was a ghost in the night, she said quietly, withdrawing back into her past, growing smaller as she remembered, the room around her fading.
I just turned 6. I remember because I didn't have a birthday party. Uncle Yehuba's cousin had come to visit, and Auntie Io said I had to stay in my room and be quiet. I didn't mind. I didn't like him. He never smiled, and he and Uncle Yehuba would get drunk on rum and talk until late. They sounded like tigers to me. One night I woke up upset. I'd been dreaming about my mother, and it was the first time her face had been blurred and half forgotten, and when I woke up I couldn't picture her at all. It was the worst thing. I wanted to go to the sitting room and look at one of the old photos taken when they were all young that Auntie Io had on the wall. It wasn't my mother's face as I knew it, but it would be at least an image of her.
It was strange how the memory she'd tried to repress for all these years came back so vividly. The damp smell of the house from having no central heating, only storage heaters that didn't work well. The feel of the flock wallpaper under her fingers, the carpet beneath her bare feet swirling in garish patterns.
I was nervous. Auntie Io said I wasn't allowed out of my room at night. She worked her best juju in the dark, she said, and clients often came at midnight or later and wanted their privacy. And if I needed to pee, there was a bucket in the corner of the room.
A black bucket that had stayed in Keisha's room until she was 13 and got her period. But by then, she would be fetching rum for the late-night visitors and taking their money while they waited. The bucket was no longer needed. She remembered how she'd felt when that had gone. Trusted. At last, part of the family, even if there was no real love there.
The house was silent and dark, so I crept out, holding my breath until I was past the bedrooms and at the top of the stairs. I could hear Uncle Yehuba's cousin snoring as I passed his door, but still, I didn't relax. I knew they'd beat me if I broke the rules. Uncle Yehuba liked to beat the devil out of me when I was wicked, especially after the boy. I was halfway down the stairs when it happened.
Her breath caught with the clarity of the memory, the release of it.
He just appeared in the corner of the downstairs hallway, stepping out of the deep shadows there, as if he'd walked through the wall. But I nearly screamed, but clutched my hand to my mouth and dropped to a crouch. He was small, I guess maybe my age, but not so tall as me. And he was so pale he glowed in the darkness. A ghost. He was a ghost, a spirit like Auntie Io would talk about. His skin was like a dead white man's, and even his tight curly hair was a snowy frosting on his head. He wore a white t-shirt and shorts, even though it wasn't warm, and he had a burn scar up one arm. I stared at him, and he stared at me, and then he turned around and disappeared into the wall again.
Dexter was scribbling notes down, although Keisha couldn't see why any of this was important.
So this was the year 2004?
He asked,
And Keisha nodded. I guess so, if I was six.
And when is your birthday?
April 4th.
Dexter paused, another scribble.
How many times did you see the boy?
7. Over about a month, I guess. Not every night, just now and then. I started to creep out to look for him when everyone was asleep. He never spoke, and he never came up close, but we would just look at each other for a few moments before I'd run back to my room. The ghost boy in the walls, that's what I thought of him as. I wondered why he always looked so sad. Sadder than me. She paused. I promised myself that I'd speak to him next time, but I never did. There was never a next time. And when I finally asked Auntie Io if she'd ever seen the ghost, she told me I was cursed. It made her want to cry. Cursed. Forever. And all because she saw a ghost. 62. Marcy had put the ball back in the trunk, not knowing what else to do with it. And as she stared out at the hospital entrance through the pouring rain, she was sure that under the steady thrum of the purring engine, she could hear it thumping against the trunk, demanding its release. It was a stupid thought. The ball was nothing, and she didn't believe in voodoo. But still she shivered, remembering the feel of matted fur and blood and God only knew what else. It was disgusting. She felt desolate and alone. She didn't know why she'd come here. William couldn't give her answers. William was simply another piece of the puzzle. Her, Keisha, Jason, and him locked together in someone else's game. Who was this actually about? All of them equally? Or were some just disposable pawns around one main target? William, Keisha, and Jason were in some kind of torturous limbo, and Marcy was pretty sure that she was soon to join them. Someone had laid a breadcrumb trail for Anderson that led to her, and she had no idea where the next blow would come from. Maybe she should run. She'd told Jason not to, and that hadn't worked out so well for him. But how far would she get? She was about to turn the car around and head home when a figure emerged through the hospital doors, head down against the steady rain. Marcy frowned as the person lifted her face for a second to see where she was going. She recognized that girl. But who was... Suddenly she had it. Of course. She leapt out of the car and ran, her drying clothes getting soaked again as she raced to catch up to the woman. Michelle! She grabbed the young woman's arm as she panted her name. Michelle from Michigan. The waitress at the club that William had taken a shine to and who'd then moved away. I thought it was you. The girl's eyes narrowed and she frowned for a moment before recognition dawned on her too. Are you going to tell me I'm not allowed in too? What? No, I was just surprised to see you. I didn't know you were still close with William. I'm not. She took care of that. But I heard what happened. I wanted to see him. Her mouth tightened. But apparently I can't. Who said you can't? And who took care of what? The nurse on reception wouldn't let me in. She had instructions, apparently. God, you'd think they'd have all gotten over our little fling now she's dead. Marcy pulled the young woman into the shadows of the building, protecting them slightly from the rain. What are you talking about? Now who's dead? The wife. The one who made me end it. She stared at Marcy. Wow, you really thought I went back to Michigan of my own accord? When I had a rich old guy who was sweet to me on a hook? Eleanor paid me to leave. She didn't give me much choice. It was that or get fired from the club and be unemployable in the city. Michelle shook her head. Eleanor knew about you and William? She summoned me to the Browning Room in the club to tell me she knew everything, and she wouldn't have me making a fool of her husband, like some dying queen in her wheelchair, all powdered and perfect. She looked dead already. No wonder William was so repulsed by her. Did William know she'd paid you off? Marcy was starting to think that Michelle from Michigan and William would have made a delightful couple, each as mean as the other. Of course not. That was the other condition. I couldn't say anything. Michelle reached in her bag for a cigarette, taking three attempts to light it in the wet air. I pitied her, so I took her money and went. No doubt planning to come back after Eleanor had died and pick up where she'd left off, Marcy thought. But William headed off to Europe, probably because he'd forgotten Michelle already, and then came back married. But it seems you people bear grudges. All I wanted was to know he was okay. And to get your foot back in that door. Well, he's not, Marcy said. He's blind and locked in, and his organs have massively failed. So even if you'd snuck into his room, you wouldn't have gotten any conversation out of him. I'm done with all of you, Michelle said, smoking hard, barely listening. Y'all think you're so much better than everyone else. Sounds like in your case, most people are. Marcy turned and walked away, ignoring the muttered bitch that followed her. She didn't care what the girl thought of her. She didn't care that the rain was soaking her to her skin again. Things were finally slotting into place. Eleanor. Everything came back to Eleanor. William had cheated on her when she was dying, and now he was half dead. Jason had tried to steal from her, and she'd suspected that he'd been involved in the death of his father, Eleanor's friend. Now he was going to prison for one crime and might be charged with murder yet. Keisha was William's new wife, married him for money, and now she was in a cell with nothing. But what about Marcy herself? Where did she fit in? One thought overrode all her questions as she raced her car back out onto the street. Eleanor was dead and buried. She couldn't be doing this. Someone else was doing it on her behalf. But who? Eleanor. Sweet, elegant Eleanor. Ghosts would always have their vengeance. 63. The main gates had been left open this time, and Marcy parked beside Iris's Mercedes before getting out and darting up the front steps before the rain could fully soak her all over again. Her heart was racing. Once again, she was back at William Radford's house. This time, she wanted answers. I wondered if you might need some food, Marcy said, holding up the deli bag as Iris opened the door. I brought a bottle of wine, too. How thoughtful of you, dear. After a moment, Iris's surprise faded, and she stepped aside and let Marcy in. There was no sign of Zelda. The main lights were off, only two table lamps glowing in the vast hallway. And Marcy shivered as she glanced up at the portrait of Eleanor still up on the wall, watching them in the gloom. Must be strange being here alone, she said. Actually, I find it quite comforting, and Eleanor's things are a treasure trove of memories to me. So much old history half forgotten. She gave Marcy an odd smile and started up the stairs. Why don't you go put that food in the kitchen and come and see if you'd like? She didn't look back as she glided up the sweeping staircase, and with a racing heart, Marcy did as she was told. She put the bag of cold cuts and cheese in the fridge, no coconut waters in there now, and left the French bread on the side. She poured two glasses of wine and took a sip from one to steady her nerves. Iris was Eleanor's oldest friend, everyone knew that. She'd cared for her throughout her illness. They'd been side by side since childhood. If anyone was taking revenge for Eleanor, it had to be Iris. Marcy crept up the stairs, as if afraid of waking the ghosts, and followed the pale yellow beam that led to Eleanor's bedroom. Iris was sitting on the bed, a small valise tipped out empty beside her, a collection of old photos. Thank you, she said, taking the glass. You should put more lights on, Marcy said. Don't you think it's creepy? I'm not afraid of the dark, Iris said. As you get older, you have to make your peace with it. Marcy thought of the disgusting black ball in the trunk of her car. I meant to ask. She perched on the mattress. Did Midge ever show up? Iris's missing cat, all black fur and yellow eyes. No, Iris said, distracted, sifting through pictures.
Sadly not. He was old. Noah says he probably crawled away to die somewhere.
Marcy could still feel the cold, rough fur under her fingertips, matted in the earth and blood. Had Iris strangled Midge before skinning him? Marcy shivered. Here in the house, it felt as if she and Iris were the last people alive. Anything could happen, and no one would hear them.
Look at this. Iris held up a photo. How young we were. I must have been maybe 16 and Eleanor 13. Those 3 years made such a difference back then.
She laughed gently.
Now 3 years is simply the bat of an eyelid.
She must have been like a sister to you.
I suppose, yes, she was.
Marcy scanned the photos. Iris had been organizing them into groups according to age, childhood to glorious youth, and then family and friends, and then just family. The last two sections weren't spread out, but stacked up. They weren't such treasure, too recent to hold any surprises.
I miss her every day, Iris continued. Getting old is no fun, Marcy. Whatever your problems now, at least you have youth.
Iris was still looking at the pictures. Whatever her problems? What was happening here? Was Iris playing innocent and waiting for the police to follow whatever trail she'd laid to Marcy? Didn't she want her to know she was responsible for it all?
Oh my, look at these short trousers, Iris said, passing one old photo over.
It was from the childhood spread.
Emmett was such a funny-looking boy.
Emmett? Marcy took the photo and looked more closely. Even as a boy, he was wearing glasses, perched high up on his nose.
He grew up with us as well. You know how close this community is. It was a lot tighter back then. Our parents were far more conservative than we are. Society mattered more to them. Your name, your money, your history.
Marcy frowned, moving through several of the pictures. The same faces came up in all of them. History rewriting itself in her head. Ghosts of people they used to be. Eleanor, Iris, Emmett, and another girl. Marcy looked more closely. She was stocky with mad dark curls, not quite filled with the confidence the others had, and her clothes didn't quite fit right. Marcy knew that look from her own childhood. Hand-me-downs. Sometimes the girl was playing with Eleanor. In one, she was laughing on a swing with Emmett. All of them aging through the glossy paper, from children to awkward teens, Eleanor blossoming into a beauty, each taking turns in front of the camera. In each image, somewhere in the background, a tall black woman was watching over them. A very tall black woman. Marcy's breath caught.
Who's that?
She asked, pointing at her. Iris's face broke into a grin.
Oh, that was Eleanor's nanny. Well, nanny and maid, really. Mama L, we called her.
She smiled.
Elizabeth's mother. That's why Elizabeth was always with us. She lived there with Mama L. My, we all loved Mama L. She came from New Orleans and seemed so fascinating. Dyed her hair orange once. And, well, Eleanor's mother nearly died at the shock of it. She'd teach us girls love spells and charms. Told us that she was a voodoo queen.
Iris laughed softly as if it had been a fairy tale.
My, how we missed her when they had to leave. I do believe that Eleanor loved Mama L more than her own mother.
Mama L was Elizabeth's mother? Marcy's throat had dried. The little girl in the hand-me-downs, Elizabeth.
Now, Elizabeth really was like Eleanor's little sister. They adored each other. And poor Emmett, of course, well, he was the reason Elizabeth and her mother had to leave.
What do you mean?
He was very taken with Elizabeth. To be fair, she was very taken with him, too.
They were only children, really, and it was harmless. But they were inseparable, and it was enough to worry his parents.
Not only because she had colored blood in her, although that would have been reason enough. As I said, they were different times. But his parents already had their eyes on Virginia for Emmett, and they shared their concerns with Eleanor's father. And so Mama L was let go, She moved back to New Orleans, I believe. But Eleanor refused to be separated from Elizabeth for long, and as soon as she could, she called Elizabeth back and hired her as her assistant. I'm pretty sure she sent money to Mama L from time to time, too. She sighed. They were such halcyon days when we were young and free.
Marcy's head was spinning, and the world once again flipped and presented itself from a new angle. She pulled out her cell phone and tapped at the screen, as if there were a message there.
Oh, shoot, she said. I have to run. Something's come up.
Iris, already forgotten, she hurried out of the house and back to the car. She sat inside for a moment before Googling for the last pieces of the puzzle, and then after collecting her thoughts, she started to drive. Her phone rang as she turned toward the hospital. Anderson. She canceled the call and turned off her cell. That could wait. If she was going to prison, she wanted to understand why. 64. Keisha was so tired. They'd been talking all day, and all she wanted to do was sleep. I don't understand why you came all the way here to ask me about a ghost I saw as a child. A boy who was never there, she said. Billy was half dead. The American police thought she was part of it, and yet here they were still talking about something that was just her madness, asking for detail after detail until she was exhausted. As if she could remember it all when she'd spent so long trying to forget. The questions about Auntie Io and Uncle Yehuba and his cousin were easier, and she'd answer them as well as she could. But they'd been talking all day, and she just wanted to sleep. She'd been back in her cell for only an hour, and now Dexter was here again. More questions, no doubt. She didn't care. She was too tired to be afraid anymore.
I think the boy was there, Keisha.
Dexter reached down into his battered briefcase and pulled out a file.
In May of 2004, a boy's torso was pulled from the Thames. Approximately 6 years of age, he'd been mutilated and his organs were missing. A day later, an arm was also recovered. That arm had a burn scar running up it.
He opened the file and pushed a photograph across the table. It was a close-up, and Keisha almost gasped. It was the same scar, she knew it. You think I saw his ghost? She asked, her voice trembling. Dexter shook his head.
I think you saw him when he was alive. My colleagues in London have been searching your aunt and uncle's home. They found a doorway in the hallway wall by the corner. Leads to an old cellar. You have to look closely for the catch, but it's there. There is evidence that at least one child was kept there at some point. We think your aunt and uncle kept this boy in the cellar until they killed him. Perhaps others, too.
No. Keisha shook her head. No, he was a ghost. He was so white, he was a ghost.
No.
Dexter's rough voice was surprisingly gentle.
He just looked like a ghost to a little girl.
He took another photo from his file and passed it over.
His name was Oliver Akimbi. His family had just moved from Nigeria to Yorkshire when he went missing.
He paused as Keisha, with shaking hands, took the picture from him.
They moved to England to keep him safe from witch doctors in Nigeria who wanted to kill him for his body parts. Sadly, your uncle's cousin followed him and brought him to your auntie. Oliver wasn't a ghost. He was an albino.
Keisha looked down at the picture, and even as the image blurred with her tears, she knew it was him, the boy who wasn't there. The tears fell heavy after that. Oliver Akimbi. A real live boy. She'd never been cursed at all. Part 4. 65. I wondered if you'd find your way here, Elizabeth said, not moving from her chair by William's hospital bed. I did hope you would. You're a smart woman, and I would have hated all my planning to have gone to waste. I've been so looking forward to sharing everything with you.
She smiled, contained, a still, calm figure compared to Marcy's fizzing energy.
Scratch the surface and history will always out. Isn't that true?
She finished.
And history makes us who we are, as you've discovered.
The room was quiet, only the hum of the machines feeding life to William. Marcy tossed the black ball from her trunk onto William's bed, and she was sure she saw a maggot wriggle away as it landed on William's legs. He didn't seem to mind. Iris's cat?
He was dying. I didn't hurt him. A conjure ball should be made with care, and I'd been fond of Midge.
She shrugged.
Plus, Iris was a little too friendly to Keisha too soon. That would have hurt Eleanor's feelings. So an eye for an eye, a hurt for a hurt.
Mama Laveau was an old voodoo queen of New Orleans at the end of the 19th century, Marcy said. Her daughter took her name and kept on practicing as the original Laveau. One daughter married a white man by the name of Glapien. Was he your daddy, Elizabeth Glapien? Is your mother the current Mama Laveau, the old woman with the crazy umber hair?
Bloodlines, Elizabeth said wryly. The rich think only theirs matter, but the poor have history too. Our blood runs deep. Do you know what they call me? The real people of Savannah?
Marcy said nothing, and so Elizabeth continued.
They call me the white voodoo. My pale skin hides my blood, but yes, Mama Laveau was my grandmother. Her blood is mine. Mama Laveau and Dr. John, old John Bayou, well, they ran New Orleans back in the old days, rivals. Mama Laveau, she had voodoo in her soul. She could do it all, just like my mama. But Dr. John, do you know what power he had?
Marcy stayed silent, and she continued.
He understood the power of information. He had servants in his pay all over New Orleans, and they told him everything about the people who lived in the big houses, all the secrets only servants knew. So when his rich clients came knocking for his help, and he already knew their business, they thought he was the most powerful voodoo doctor. I have some of my mother's magic. I can curse with a spit if I so wish. But I prefer Dr. John's methods. Times don't really change. To William, I was simply an assistant, but he trusted me with everything. Funny, isn't it? I know all his business, most of his friends' business, most of his clients' business. Some of them have actually become mine and Mama's clients. So Mama takes care of the voodoo, and I take care of the information, and between us, we have made a little fortune of our own. Eleanor knew. Eleanor loved and respected us. Eleanor believed in the power of our magic.
Marcy looked at the half-dead figure in the bed. You did this for Eleanor, didn't you? Elizabeth sighed and squeezed William's hand.
Eleanor was going to murder William herself. That's why she had the morphine and the needles hidden away. She'd put them to one side and she was going to kill him in his sleep.
Why? Because of the waitress? Surely Eleanor wouldn't have resorted to murder over someone as obviously trashy as Michelle from Michigan.
No, of course not. Because of what the waitress represented. His lack of respect, his lack of love or care. You weren't there. You didn't see how much it had taken from Eleanor to forgive him for Lyle. Lyle was her heart. Oh, he was such a beautiful boy. He deserved a long and happy life. If it wasn't for William, he might have had one. His death nearly destroyed Eleanor. It broke my heart, but that was nothing next to watching her pain. But she was a good person, and she wanted to forgive William, not only for Lyle's death, but for making him join up in the first place, for something so opposite to his nature. She made herself forgive him. She locked Lyle away in a box so William wouldn't feel guilty, and she strived to make the marriage work. And I guess on some level it did.
But then Eleanor got sick, Marcy said.
Yes, and it became clear very quickly that William wasn't good with illness. He hid from it, barely spending time with Eleanor, sleeping in a guest bedroom. And then, when Eleanor was diagnosed as terminal, and not even Mama or I could do anything to stop it, he started his fling with that girl. As if Eleanor wasn't suffering enough. I didn't blame Eleanor for wanting to kill him, but I couldn't let her do it. She looked up at Marcy and smiled. She was a beautiful woman inside and out. I wouldn't let her ruin herself, her soul, for William. I stopped her. I had planned to retire and go back to New Orleans with Mama once Eleanor had passed. I'd made enough money through our private services to the wealthy of Savannah. Tarot readings, love spells, advice, curses. When you can get that stuff right, people will pay you anything you want. Plus, Eleanor hadn't left me forgotten in her will. We were like sisters, after all. She smiled again, softly but sadly this time, remembering her friend. So yes, I was looking forward to relaxing into a quiet, comfortable luxury of my own. But although I wouldn't let her kill William, neither could I let her die without peace of mind. So I promised her on her deathbed that I'd take care of all of it. I'd kill William for her. It was her dying wish. She paused. There's a lot of power in a dying wish. Maybe not so much, Marcy said. He's not dead. I'm not as kind as Eleanor, Elizabeth laughed. There are some fates worse than death. William's alive on a whim. Watching him when Eleanor was dying, I learned a lot about that fat old man. Dying terrified him. The weakness of it. The becoming irrelevant as life moved on. He wanted a quick death, which, to be fair, is what Eleanor was planning to give him. But he didn't deserve that. Why should he get a clean death while Eleanor had to rot slowly? No. She shook her head. Eleanor and Lyle deserved more than that after so many years of having him controlling them. But look at him now. Trapped here, locked in the dark of his own mind, no power at all. The visitors will stop coming. All he has is me, sitting here, whispering to him about Lyle and Eleanor, and how he failed them, and how this whole situation is his own fault. He'll live a while, but eventually, if his organs don't fail entirely, the machine will be turned off. Then he'll be dead. That will be the moment of mercy. But what about the rest of us? Me and Keisha and Jason? She paused. Quiet, subservient Elizabeth had done all this to them. It would be laughable if it wasn't so terrifying. Elizabeth and her crazy mother, voodoo queens. Ah, the replacement wife, mentally unstable and from a juju background full of secrets. The liar, hiding her colorful past in a box in the ceiling. And finally, the thief, who didn't even learn his lesson after his father's death. A perfect cast of characters for Eleanor's revenge, all shackled to ghosts of the dead. A boy, a husband, a father. You think you know so much about us, Marcy sneered, angry. But you don't. Oh, but I do. As I said, information is my business. I had Keisha's life investigated for William, and when you arrived on the scene, I did the same. I research everyone who comes into my circles. You always find something useful. She stared at Marcy, and despite the warmth in her eyes, Marcy shivered. And my, was your past useful? You're going to let them go to prison for a murder they didn't commit. And what about me? Why the stupid doll and the disgusting ball? Why does everyone presume voodoo is curses and devils? Elizabeth said. So wrong. Some spells curse and bind, and some protect. Good or bad. It's all karma. Which was mine? Or Keisha's? Elizabeth didn't answer, but stood up and went to the window. The police are here, she said. They'll have traced the email to your old high school back to Jason's office computer. They still don't know who sent it, but they may well now be thinking that you were a menage a trois. You were sleeping with both of them, after all, and Jason could well have met Keisha when he went to London. He didn't, by the way. Like I said, information is my magic. But I digress. Now, here's where you come in. I'm not going to send anyone to jail. You are. What do you mean? Marcy was so over this shit. I'm going to give you a choice. Jason or Keisha. Elizabeth turned and smiled. I can make it so that one of them goes free, and one goes to jail for William's attempted murder. What? Keisha or Jason? Which do you want to save? The errant husband or the flighty girlfriend? Time's ticking on. Marcy looked down at the barely living body in the bed. She felt sick. She felt relieved. She felt like she was stuck in a fever dream. But what if William dies? That could be the death penalty. There was a noise behind them in the corridor. Detective Anderson and her sidekick arriving. Yes, Elizabeth said pleasantly. It will be. But it won't be you facing it. She winked. And Marcy, just before answering, decided Elizabeth was mad. 66. As Elizabeth had said they would, the police had taken Marcy in for further questioning after discovering the email to the high school came from Jason's work computer, a computer that Marcy had plenty of access to. Marcy hadn't answered any of their questions this time, as Kate Anderson quizzed her, trying to find out if all three of them, Marcy, Keisha, and Jason, were in it together. It all was just as Elizabeth had said it would be. Marcy hadn't bothered to try to defend herself. It felt odd putting her faith in Elizabeth that she wouldn't be charged, but she found that she did. After all, Elizabeth had been pulling their strings for long enough. Instead, as Anderson had talked to her, she'd zoned out while putting the pieces of Elizabeth's plan together in her head. Thankfully, finally, the detectives were called out, leaving her alone in the room with her thoughts. It was almost to be respected how intricate Elizabeth's plan had been. She'd known all about Keisha before she even arrived in the city. Emmett had been in love with Elizabeth, and so no doubt made sure that Jason's investments weren't going to pay out in time. Maybe he even encouraged Jason, at Elizabeth's behest, to invest money he didn't have. The figure she'd half recognized at the rave, not Zelda, but Elizabeth standing behind her mother, serpent in her arms. She must have arranged for their drinks to be drugged to make Keisha more susceptible to the voodoo. The more unstable she was, the more unhappy William would be. Also, the drugs made them looser, hotter for each other, and that was how they got the photo. Enough to make William angry that night and want to keep away from the party and tell Noah he wanted a divorce. Marcy thought about the coolant. Elizabeth had done all the organizing for the new car and no doubt had a spare key. The light came on after she and Keisha had gone to see Julian and Pierre when they fucked in the car, and Elizabeth had met them there. She could easily have loosened the cap to make it leak. Elizabeth could have been in the kitchen and injected the cartons at any point after she returned to the party. Julian and Pierre had brought their own catering Winnebago for the canapes and parked it around the back. Sorry to keep you waiting. Detectives Anderson and Washington came back into the room, and only then did Marcy realize that her hands were cold and legs numb from sitting still. How long had they been gone? There has been a development, which means that you're free to go. Marcy got to her feet, despite the pins and needles running through her calves. What do you mean? We've found the syringe used to inject the coconut water cartons and a small water bottle containing coolant. Marcy's eyes widened. What have you done now, Elizabeth? I don't understand. Behind the cutlery drawer in the Radford House kitchen. There's an odd gap there at the back that can only be accessed if you pull the drawer out at a certain angle. Did you know about it? Marcy nodded. Yes, but
if you were involved in the attempted murder and hid them there, or knew they were there, you've since had opportunity to remove them.
Marcy's blank face prompted further explanation.
You were at the Radford house earlier this evening, and Iris Cartwright tells us you were left alone in the kitchen.
She paused.
Lucky for you.
So I can go?
Yes, we won't be charging you.
Marcy wanted to laugh out loud. Oh, Elizabeth, how you played us. She was free, and if she wasn't mistaken, if Elizabeth had stood by the choice she'd given Marcy, the future was looking pretty bright. 67. It was a decadently hot night in the Bahamas, but a slight breeze blew in through the fluttering curtains and was delicious on Marcy's naked skin. It had been a long few months, and they deserved this holiday away from everything. Everything had played out as Elizabeth predicted. The syringe and bottle had only Jason's fingerprints on them. The conclusion drawn was that he must have planned William's death alone and had to quickly ditch the murder equipment in the broken drawer space after being interrupted by Elizabeth on the night of the party when Keisha had started shouting at Zelda. Both Marcy and Keisha had the opportunity to retrieve and dispose of them, and they hadn't. If either had been involved in any way, they would have. Poor Jason. He'd vehemently denied his guilt throughout the trial, which hadn't exactly helped his case. And Marcy had felt the hatred coming off him in waves as she played her own part, weeping quietly on the stand, giving evidence against him. So that was it. Jason had gotten life for attempted murder, and the trial for his financial wrongdoings was upcoming. She wondered what evidence Elizabeth would have produced if Marcy had chosen differently. Something equally compelling against Keisha, no doubt. But she hadn't chosen differently. Why would she? She'd been getting bored with Jason before any of this happened, and she'd never bought into that stand-by-your-man philosophy. Can I ask you something? Keisha murmured. And you won't get mad.
She was curled on her side, one hand protecting her growing belly, Billy having left her with more than money after all. Was it going to be another request for reassurance? Keisha, although still glorious in bed and now fabulously wealthy, was turning out to be quite needy.
Sure, Marcy whispered in reply. It's really stupid, but I just need to hear it from you. You didn't have anything to do with what happened to Johnny, did you?
No, of course not.
Marcy looked down at her.
You really have to ask that?
I'm sorry, Keisha said, reaching up to kiss her. I didn't mean it. It's just all been so crazy with Auntie Ayo and Uncle Yehuba having murdered that poor boy and maybe others, and then what Jason did. It's just all such madness, it's making me question everything. Ignore me, I'm being stupid. I'm sorry.
You don't need to be sorry. Marcy leaned down and kissed her.
But you can trust me. I love you.
They kissed more deeply, and for a while Marcy let Keisha's glorious body do the apologizing. Afterward, as Keisha slept, satiated, Marcy stared into the night, at last alone with her thoughts. You can't cage a wild thing. Marcy was a wild thing, always had been, and nothing could change that. Johnny. She sank back into the memories, how her heart had raced walking back into the trailer, not knowing whether he'd be dead or alive, or if he'd even drunk the laced whiskey at all. The contrived argument the day before, and then storming out to go to work. The shot of clean whiskey she'd secretly slipped in his coffee to give him a taste for liquor again. Staying out all night drinking and dancing with Janie, turned on by not knowing if her plan was working or not. Oh, yes. How her heart had raced when she'd walked into the trailer and saw him there on the floor, eyes wide, frozen in terror. Dead. And it had been so easy. Johnny always had stuff for the cars in the trailer. Oil, batteries, coolant. And sure, Johnny had straightened out for a while, but alcoholics relapse. and there was enough doubt to get her off scot-free. So what if an air of suspicion hung over her? She'd had no intention of staying in Boise. God, she'd been banking on Johnny drinking himself to death, and then she'd swan off with his payout. But no, he had to decide to get himself together, to start talking about a baby again, trapping her in that life. She couldn't have that. She'd rather die. Or, as it turned out, she'd rather he died. Sociopath. That was the word the police had used about her back in Boise, even if they couldn't prove it. Same word they all used about Jason now. Like attracts like, she guessed. If she'd known what Jason was up to with the client accounts, she'd have probably killed him too, but perhaps more imaginatively than she had Johnny. She'd grown as a person since then. Maybe even without the money troubles, she'd have ended up getting rid of husband number two. She'd been getting bored, and he'd been getting tiring with his sudden need to reproduce. She'd never wanted a child. What if it turned out to be like her? Keisha murmured in her sleep. Ah, the irony. Marcy had never wanted kids, and here she was, soon to be saddled with co-parenting a screaming brat. But it would be worth it for the final financial result. Keisha, for all her charm, was fragile and needy, and like a child herself. For now, Marcy found it quite sweet, especially given all of poor William's money Keisha had to spend on her, constantly trying to impress her and prove she loved her. But she was pretty sure that within a couple of years, it would get cloying. But still, they'd be married by then. One thing all this had taught Marcy about herself was that she found love to be fleeting. She obsessed about a person and then she got bored. That was how love was for her. She'd gotten bored with Johnny, and she'd gotten bored with Jason. One day she'd get bored with Keisha too. But Keisha had a history of mental health issues. She may have weaned herself off the Valium because of the pregnancy, but it wouldn't be that hard to get her back on them, and then to arrange an overdose or an accident. Send the kid to boarding school, and live a life of luxury. Yes, she thought, kissing the top of Keisha's head. The future was turning out very nicely indeed. Epilogue. Don't be so angry. Some would call it poetic justice that you're in here, Elizabeth said across the visiting room table. On the other side, Jason looked as if he could murder her. Life with no possibility of parole. She shrugged. Although I can see how it might not feel that way to you, especially as it could, and will, get so much worse.
How could it get any worse?
Jason's bitterness dripped from him. The guilty were so often bitter, she found. Despite their own crimes, any small injustice stung them hard. One of life's ironies. He hadn't taken her confession well, it had to be said. He was going to take this snippet of information worse, although he really should have thought it through earlier. She was starting to think that Jason Maddox wasn't too bright.
When William dies, she said simply, which he will in the next few days, I'm tired of whispering to him what a shit he is. I think he's gotten the message now. He's given up and shutting down. His organs are becoming more unstable. Even the doctors think that turning the machines off is for the best. And after I leave here, I shall be persuading his legal representatives that death is the kindest route for him.
What are you talking about?
The first hint of fear cracking through his anger.
What has that got to do with me?
It's obvious, isn't it? If William dies, then you're guilty of first-degree murder, and that's the death penalty.
She smiled at him cheerfully.
And that will happen. Your appeal will fail. Admittedly, you may spend some years on death row, but trust me, you will get the injection.
Bullshit. You can't know that.
But I can. I do. I see it. The great Mama Laveau's blood runs in mine. You can believe in it or not, but that doesn't change mine or my mama's powers. What will be, will be.
Why the fuck are you here, Elizabeth?
His words were spat nails, but his face was pale.
I wondered if you knew why you were here, why I put you behind these bars.
Because you're a psycho bitch.
Oh, Jason, really? No need for insults. Actually, no, you're here because I gave your wife a choice. I told her I could arrange for one of you to go free and one of you to go to jail. A choice between you and Keisha. She chose to set Keisha free and leave you to face all this. You, her husband. I guess till death do us part means something different to Marcy. But yes, she chose the money over saving your life. His eyes widened.
Marcy did this?
In her own way, yes.
They sat in silence for a few moments while the truth of it all soaked into Jason's skin, settling inside him like a strange acceptance.
Keisha might be a dumb bitch, but she never did anything wrong, Jason said eventually. What if Marcy had chosen her to be guilty? You'd have let her face the death penalty?
Keisha was never going to end up in your position, Elizabeth said. I knew how Marcy would choose. She would always save the rich woman over her criminal husband. And anyway, Keisha was protected. As I told Marcy, not everything is a curse. Voodoo is a healing practice. That's what most people don't understand. And it works in balance. To do what I've done for Eleanor, to take this revenge for her, there had to be a balance of good. Keisha was the balance. A poor girl haunted throughout her life by someone else's crimes. I have put her through the fire, but she is now set free. She has money. She has no grasping family or domineering husband. She can finally be herself. No harm will come to her. I told Marcy that conjure balls and dolls can protect or curse, she continued. Keisha's were to protect her always. Marcy couldn't harm her. It had to be you. Karma for your father, don't you think?
The steely cold look on Jason's face made it clear that he had no time for karma.
Anyway, she continued, giving people a choice is like a magic trick. You should always know what their answer will be in advance. With Marcy, that was easy. She already killed one husband. I doubted she'd have any qualms about making a choice to kill another.
You think she killed Johnny? Jason asked.
I spent time in her hometown. I talked to her old friends. The woman she was out drinking with that night, the night Johnny died, she said she'd seen it in her face when they came back into the trailer. A moment of victory. She said Marcy hated being married. She'd hoped he'd die. And then he did. How rare that the terrible things we hope for actually happen. Yes, I think she killed Johnny.
She leaned across the table conspiratorially.
And more than that, my mama says she knows she did. It's in the air around her. Bad juju.
But she's out there walking around without a care in the world, Jason said. With Keisha and all William's money. And you can't do anything for me to help me.
He couldn't keep the pleading desperation out of his voice.
Nothing?
I'm afraid not, Elizabeth said with a sigh as she leaned back in her chair. There was a third choice for Marcy, you know.
What do you mean?
She could have refused to choose. She could have let justice run its course. That's what a decent person would have done, don't you think? A good person? She could have told Detective Anderson everything I'd said and added another suspect to the part. But no, Marcy didn't even consider that option. She only considered what was best for her.
Elizabeth studied Jason thoughtfully before leaning back in close to the glass.
I can't save you. No one can do that. But I granted the wish of a dying woman, and now I can grant the wish of a dying man. There's power in a dying man's wish.
Jason's eyes narrowed, confused.
What do you mean?
I'll give you a choice, just like I gave your wife. Would you like me to leave Marcy be? To let her live her life regardless of the harm she causes others, regardless of her slow murder of you in here? Do you love her enough for that? Or, she smiled, would you like me to take her own life from her when she's least expecting it? A fitting punishment for a murderess, perhaps. As I did with William for Eleanor. She paused. The choice is yours. Jason smiled, and as her eyes burned, Elizabeth knew he could see the serpents shining in them.
I know what I choose, he said.
This is Saskia Merleveld. We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of Dead to Her, a novel by Sarah Pinborough, presented by William Morrow and Harper Audio. This program was produced by John Marshall Media. Executive producer, Suzanne Franco Mitchell. Text copyright, 2020, by Sarah Pinborough. Production copyright, 2020, by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.